When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Save big money on plant protection supplies now at Menards. Defend your garden with Triazicide Insect Killer. Its fast-acting formula protects lawns, vegetables, and many other plants. It kills more than 260 insects by contact, above and below ground. Choose from ready to spray, concentrate, or granular. Save big money on Triazicide Insect Killer at Menards. And check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
Today on Lightning Bugs.
I think this should be an assignment for you for this pod or something. I think, and it would be a great YouTube video that would show up on my algorithm. Ben Folds talks his way through the 10 greatest bridges of all time. Folks, are you listening? Can we pin Ben down on this? The 10 greatest bridges of all time. Laughing on the bus, playing games with the faces. She said the man in the gabardine suit was a spy.
That's good.
Hi, if you're enjoying listening to Lightning Bugs, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. It helps a lot.
One, two, three.
Check this out. I'm going to do an intro. All right. Hello. We're here with another episode of Lightning Bugs. Today's guest is Rainn Wilson. He's an actor slash writer best known for playing the role of Dwight Schrute on NBC's Emmy-winning show The Office. Wilson co-founded Soul Pancake, a digital media company that seeks to tackle life's big questions, and Lead A Foundation, an educational initiative in rural Haiti that empowers at-risk women and girls through the arts. Wilson co-hosts a podcast called Metaphysical Milkshake with Reza Aslan. We did a crossover episode in October, which you can find on both the Lightning Bugs and the Metaphysical Milkshake feeds. So here he is, Rainn Wilson.
Greatest introduction ever. Thanks, Ben Folds.
Oh, yeah, yeah. This is not my day job doing this stuff. And I kind of thought I'd start with asking you, when you do these, because you've done more of them than I have, What's usually your way in with a guest? How can you help me out? Like, well, do you have a formula? Like the first question you ask is going to be a bleh, or?
You know, that's a great question. Actually, I think that's a terrific question. So for Metaphysical Milkshake, we usually have a theme that we bring a guest on. Sometimes we have a theme and then we find the right guest for the theme. Sometimes we find a guest we really want to talk about and then find the theme or the life's big question that we want to tackle with that particular guest. So that's a little bit different in that we kind of want to get into an idea rather than a biography. You know, we always try and have some biography of people being on the show, but whenever I do pods that are having to do with like getting to know someone or something about them, I guess what always works out best for the interviewer and interviewee is like, what's that one thing about the person that kind of like excites you to want to talk to them about? I don't know that there's anything about me, Ben, that you're going to want to, that you don't already know that you want to ask me. But if there was like that thing, like if I was interviewing you, it would be like, it's 1998 and you're on the road and you've got a piano in the back of your van, you know, going to a gig in Asheville. What's that like? What was your life on the road like, you know, kind of before you broke and then after you guys became like the biggest band in the universe? Like I would go something like that, because I've always in my head there's the legend of Ben Folds and his piano and trying to like fit his piano into venues.
Yeah. You know? And I can't remember the venue in Seattle. I remember the way it felt, and it was really small. Not the more that we started doing later, but there was a tiny place.
Was it Music Box?
Yes. That's it. I'm sure that's it. That sounds right.
Yeah.
And we fit a piano on the stage, you know, parked the truck and put the piano in there. But yeah. See, you're so good. You started asking the questions, and I forgot that I was asking you the questions.
You know what? Let me take this from here. I got this.
You've got it now. No, but check it out. Because I was thinking about like, because I've done a few of these today. So I was kind of stuck on, gosh, you know, what's the difference between a podcast and an interview? And like, is there a way that I never studied this? Like, is there a way that people typically get into them? One person told me one time, if you ask a short question, you'll get a long answer. And if you ask a long question, you'll get a short answer. Have you noticed that?
Oh, that sounds, I haven't heard that, but that actually sounds kind of right.
Yeah. So if you wanted the person to talk a lot, you would ask them some quick, short question to begin with, I guess. And that would be it. That's not really why I'm here. Yeah. I mean, it's not really why we're here, but I was thinking, okay. So right before we came on, I sort of meditated on Rainn Wilson for like 15 seconds. And I thought, what's the first thing that comes to mind that I would want to talk about? And the first thing that came to mind was oddly, well, first of all, I saw online psychics. I just thought just really quickly, I thought about online psychics. And I think the reason I thought about that was because people who go to them need to hear a very specific outcome. I assume that they're attached to an outcome. And I've known some people who've had this problem before.
Okay.
And I think that you are the opposite of that. Like, I don't know you, but you seem to me not to be attached almost at all to controlling and hanging on to things. Would that be crazy or accurate?
Well, God, that's such an interesting question. I don't know how to respond to that. So, you know, my life is a lot of different avenues. So I have my family life, right, with my wife and son mostly, and other family members. And I don't talk too much about that. But in that realm, when you're raising a teenager, you just don't know what's going to happen. I mean, it's just day to day. So there's a certain measure of like just surrendering control that is forced upon you. I mean, I would love for my son to get good grades, find something he's passionate about, get into he didn't get into Stanford, but, you know, get into a college that will, you know, turn him on to learning and, you know, go on a life journey and not suffer too much before 21, let's say. Like,
then let all hell rain down.
Yeah, just suffer away in your 20s. That's kind of what your 20s is about anyways. Yeah. Making mistakes, suffering, screwing yourself up, bad decisions, wrong dead ends. But you want to protect them a little bit. But, you know, I don't know if that's going to happen. I mean, who knows? Yeah. And then there's, you know, my career, which is weird because, you know, I did theater for 10 years before I did any TV or film. So here I was thinking of myself as like this kind of weird theater actor doing plays and whatnot. And then I realized if I ever wanted to own a house, I would need to do some TV and film. So I came to LA and then really struggled there. But then, you know, obviously found some success in 2003, 2004.
So you were doing tons of theater, and then that probably really shifted to mostly being on camera.
Yeah, pretty much. I've only done a handful of plays in the last 20 years or so.
Yeah. Do you miss doing that?
But you're talking about like going with the flow, like it's some of both, you know. I would like to have a larger career than I have right now. I think, you know, 99% of all actors would like that. Yeah. I would love to be offered some really cool and interesting, you know, character roles in a Quentin Tarantino film that I'm not being offered. Yeah. But, you know, a lot of that's out of my control, so I can just do what is in my control, you know. And then, you know, the other aspect is, you know, I have this kind of weird double life as someone who's interested in spirituality and spiritual mm-hmm. journeys and philosophies. So that is all about, you know, surrendering to the flow of the universe. So it's easier kind of said than done. It's easier theoretically than to put into practice.
Absolutely. Did you, and in all the phases that you've been in, like you get, is it right that Soul Pancake is coming to an end? Is that correct?
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It's, we sold Soul Pancake to an awesome media company called Participant Media, and they're really fantastic. They've done some of your guaranteed a dozen or two dozen of your favorite films of the last 20 years they've been a part of. They did Green Book. They won Oscars, Spotlight, An Inconvenient Truth, Judas and the Black Messiah. The list goes on and on. Cool, relevant, socially relevant films. And we kind of came on to be their digital arm right at the time when like digital companies were kind of drying up. And so they've kind of folded Soul Pancake into what they're doing with their movies. And so it started as a digital media company, its own YouTube channel, producing content, you know, kind of lower budget, short form digital content, branded content, working with sponsors. That's kind of coming to an end. And now we're just kind of taking the Soul Pancake ethos and team and working on the participant vision.
Okay, so you'll still be involved. It's just a business thing, or
yeah, I'm not so involved anymore, and it's just shifted to a participant thing. But you know, when you sell a company, you always have that. We knew when we sold it that there was a chance that this would happen, but at the same time, like we did 12 years of amazing content. We made 7,000 videos. We got 1 billion video views.
It's incredible.
Lots and lots of viral videos and lots of really uplifting videos that helped make people's lives better. Hopefully they found some hope, some illumination, some light from the content that we produced.
Was it trying to be light in an arena that was filled with a lot of sarcasm and dark stuff and violent people and mean shit? Or did you think of it that way?
Yeah. I mean, in 2007, 2008, when we were first having conversations about Soul Pancake and we really got up and running like 2009, it was a response to what we all saw, me and my co-founders saw on the web. It was also a anecdote, antidote, not an antidote. Not an anecdote.
An anecdotal antidote.
Yes. To the kind of mean-spirited crassness and lowest common denominator stuff that was on the web at that time. I think now you can find more positive stuff. I mean, even if you just go on Instagram and TikTok and follow positive content creators, you can get inspiring messages. But back in 2008, that it really was all Kardashian butts and credit scores and, you know, fails. You know, remember those fails? Like,
yeah.
You know, and so I also thought, like, you know, kind of cannily, like, well, I think that there's a market here, you know, just to be a little bit kind of commercial and capitalist, like, oh, I bet you there's an audience that is really interested in watching positive content. And well,
I think that's an important point. I mean, this podcast series being something that I'm just chasing creativity, I love knowing, you know, what all makes someone tick, like why you make something in the first place. And I think there being a need and a capitalistic opportunity is completely valid.
Yeah.
I mean,
especially if that need, like this podcast, serves the greater good. You know, if you can, it's win-win-win all around. If you are doing something positive for the world and you're in a business practice that is I don't even want to say lucrative, but, you know, successful.
This isn't.
Employing people and, yeah. you know, bills are getting paid and mortgages are getting paid. And then it's win-win all around. And I think that people often discount that as a possibility. And it's tricky to do. You've got to be really smart. There's a lot of like really well-meaning and well-intentioned people out there trying to do it and not succeeding. But and it doesn't help, you know, and it helps. I was a big celebrity at the time. The Office was just taking yeah. off and people were like, who's this Rainn Wilson guy? And social media was just taking off and I was promoting it on my social media and, you know, that kind of helped feed the fire.
Absolutely. It's definitely time. I mean, as soon as my band had, or we knew we were about to have a hit, The Basic Fix was in, I started running the list of all the irresponsible label money I could possibly spend. You know, like how can I do some things I've always wanted to do that are experimental, and just went for it. And that was my uh-huh. window, you know, like I made an instrumental record that I didn't put my name on, of course, and stuff like that. And it's
right.
It's a great thing to do. When you go back to like the top of your artistic journey, and it's mostly about acting, how much of that felt creative to you? Because I can see acting both ways. I can see it as taking marching orders and interpreting, but I can also see it as a creative thing. Where did that sit for you to begin with?
I love that question so much. It makes me so happy that you asked me that question. Because at heart, I am an artist, and I hope to always be an artist, and I started as an artist. There might be some people listening kind of rolling their eyes like, oh, anyone who calls themselves an artist, mm-hmm. ugh. You know, this is kind mm-hmm. of an eye roll thing. But truly, the craft of acting is an incredible art form.
Yeah.
When you think about, and especially kind of going to theater, that there's a bunch of pages, right?
Yeah.
And there's a bunch of pages and there's lines on it and it says Steve : hey, who forgot to take the dog out? And then yeah. it says Marty, like, my bad, sorry. Anyone want anything from the deli? You know,
this is good, like, actually.
It's pretty good, right?
Yeah.
That you've got all that stuff but you don't know like who Steve is or who Marty is or
yeah.
there's clues in the script. Or why they forgot to take the dog out, or why he's going to the deli, or are they lovers, or are they roommates, or are they father and son? Like, you know, you discover these things, there's clues in the script, but then bringing Steve to life and bringing Marty to life, like, there's something really miraculous and cool and mystical and undefinable about that.
I love that.
Because there's 1,000 choices on who wants something from the deli, you know, kind of be like, you know, did someone just die and they're trying to cheer someone up? Is he genuinely trying to be of service? Is there, you know, is he being passive aggressive because, you know, the other people never go to the deli and he's the only one who goes to the deli? You know, what's the emotional context? And there's always subtext. So what are the like the 7 things he's thinking and feeling underneath the yeah. very simple line of anyone want anything from the deli? And then how do you do that? Well, you know, you rehearse and you work with the director, you answer all the questions you can, and you try as much as possible to get into the shoes of Marty and Steve, see the world through their eyes. You try and live and breathe as Marty and Steve. Mm. You try and inhabit their body with your own body. And since you're using your own body, you're also using your own thoughts and your own feelings and your own experiences.
Right.
And so how do you draw on your own experience? Me, you know, Rainn Wilson, having roommates, having relationships with other dudes. Like, how do I draw on that? Like, mm-hmm. is there humor? Is it appropriate to bring humor into that moment? Do you right. want to get a laugh on that? Like, who wants something from the deli? And then you drop your yeah. smoothie on the floor and it splashes and you're like, oh man, and it gets a big laugh. Maybe that's not the right moment for that. So there's all of these choices, choice, 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 choice. And then, but then when an audience sits down in a theater, we'll say a theater instead of TV or film, to watch the ballad of Marty and Steve, like, they don't care about any of that. They just want to see Marty and Steve in their kitchen with the journey to the deli and with the apparels right. of the dogs. And they want to just get to know these characters and just go and be told a story, because we loved storytelling. Humans love to just sit there. Yes. Someone's telling a good story. We love to just sit there and let Absolutely. That story unfold in our imaginations. We want to be transported. We want to be captivated. We want to be touched. We want to laugh. And so being a part of that process, even if you're not like the director, right? Like, who's kind of putting it all together. You're just Marty, or you're playing Steve, is just, it's fascinating and exciting and wonderful.
Were these things you were thinking about when you began? Were those notions of how you bring someone to life and who they are, were you fascinated with people and characters and what was behind their eyes? Or were you more fascinated with the idea of you go out and you're actually on stage doing it?
Some of both. I was always kind of a ham.
Right.
I was a weird, misfit little child, and I never really fit in anywhere. And those are the kind of people usually drawn to theater.
Yeah.
And being a theater geek. And so I went to, I moved to this new school in Chicago and had an amazing acting program, and the teachers were incredible. And, you know, I'll never forget, I was a junior in high school. I had just transferred there, and I signed up for this acting class, and the assignment was called Private in Public. So it's just yourself in your room doing what you would do in your room, and people are just watching.
Ah, interesting. Interesting.
So I brought in my record player and a bunch of records. And I was just kind of in my room, kind of goofing around. And then I put on Mystery Dance by Elvis Costello.
Yeah.
And I started just like dancing around and singing to it. And just like a fool. And people were just laughing and just going crazy. And they came up to me. And this was literally like day 7 of this new semester at this new school. And all of these like cute girls were like, "Oh, wow, you're so funny. Where are you from? You're from Seattle. Oh my God." And sorry, I don't mean to be denigrating to them, but they spoke very intelligently and articulately. They didn't speak like Valley girls, but they, and all of a sudden it was like, wow, I didn't have cute girls paying attention to me. And I hadn't made a room full of people laugh. So there was that performative element, and I hope you like me and please accept me kind of emotional undercurrent. And at the same time, though, we did a series of exercises where I remember if we were working on a scene, she would do this exercise where she would put a letter with a piece of information on it, like, "Your wife is dead." And you go into your space as your character, do some work, and then open the letter and read it and have just a natural reaction as your character would react to that piece of news.
Yeah.
So I remember I was doing like a Greek tragedy play, and then I did get like the letter that like, "Your wife has killed herself" or something like that. And like, it was so mysterious. It was just so cool. Like, how do you react to the news, your wife? I mean, you might just stare at that blank face for 3 minutes, or you might start weeping and wailing, or you might just melt, or you might collapse on the floor. You might, there's limitless choices in front of you, and it can be daunting, but I found that really exciting early on.
Well, that, you know, and my brain just jumps in all sorts of abstracts, which is where we started, and I'm not sure that was a good way to get in and ask. But two things about what you said go back to what I was thinking at the beginning when I think about what you do, and one has to do with living on the line between really on the line of surprise, of discovery at that moment, because if you know lines, you know them. But you have to, like, certainly you have to, what I would think would make a really great actor, and what I think is one of the great things about how you operate, is it always does seem like this is the moment and it's a surprise. Of course, you know what it's going to be. But
let me just say a piece on that, because that's what my acting teacher in college called like the illusion of the first time. Like you may be doing, let's go into a play. You may have done the play 87 times and your character opens a letter and reads a note that says your wife has just killed herself. And you know kind of what you're going to do. You may not know it 100%, but the audience has to just feel completely that it's just happening fresh and in the moment. So that keeping that spontaneity, I suppose it's more like a jazz musician that knows it's going to get somewhere, but doesn't know exactly how they're going to get to that point. And that's why a lot of actors like to do stuff like Marlon Brando would wear an earpiece and get his lines fed to him or hang up his lines around, because he wanted to get into that place where he could kind of discover it fresh in the moment. He also was fat and lazy and drug addicted.
Yeah.
But there is something to be said for that. I don't think it's sustainable, but there's something to be said for those methods of working to try and keep things as fresh as possible. You know, there's that scene.
There's a
story from Apocalypse Now that he would, he took one of his lines, wrote it on a piece of paper, licked it, and then stuck it to the side of Martin Sheen's head. So he had his line on the side of Martin Sheen's head, and Martin Sheen was like looking off camera right. And then, so he'd be like, oh, listen. And he would look at the, like, all I see in the night is the jungle of the soul or whatever. And Martin Sheen felt like he couldn't move his head because he had Marlon Brando's line.
Jeez.
Pasted all to about, his temple with
all
his
about
spit.
Him. Forget about what Martin was having to go through. Yes. It didn't matter.
Yeah, a little narcissism there. Anyway, sorry.
Well, but those are all ways, tricks of getting you into it. Now, I suppose there must be some, I feel like you have a natural talent somehow, or have done it so that you actually do seem like it as a surprise. And I say that because as soon as I started having to do some bits of acting myself, I found that the most impossible thing. Like I know what's going to happen. I can't unknow what's going to happen. Like that's not what I'm good at. I don't have that naturally in there, but it seems like you do. And, you know, the other thing, I just wrote down the word approval, because when you just mentioned, you know, like you get a laugh out of something like you've got three ways you could play this. Maybe if someone hands you a piece of paper and that's got news on it, and you could go for the most approval ever, which would be the laugh. That seems like that would be the most satisfying approval that you could get. That would be demonstrative. And I know that when I've been in a sort of an acting place, I leaned towards that, doing something that would just get a laugh because that was approval. You know, but that doesn't make it the best.
Yeah.
The best for the moment, you know.
Yeah.
And I don't know if there's a question in there. It's just a concept.
But I talked about kind of approval seeking and just wanting to be liked.
But you don't seem like you go that way to me. You seem
I don't anymore. I had a lot of therapy. I've really had a lot of therapy along the way, but that was my driving impulse for most of my adult life is, you know, please love me. Please adore me. I think there's something central to the actor's experience that is like, please like me. No one else has ever really liked me. Do you see me? So, and going
well, your livelihood depends on approval.
Yeah. You know, And then oddly enough, so the more you care about approval, the more kind of sweaty and pushed your performance is.
Exactly, which is kind of where I was thinking, yeah.
Yeah, and so then that, you see, that doesn't work. So then you pretend to not care.
Yes.
But you really care, but you're trying, you get better at pretending to not care.
Yeah, no one cares really more,
When actors are really able to deliver and just give magnificent performances, it's just when they don't give a flying fuck. And that's actually when the audiences are able to kind of go, wow, I want more of that. I want to see that going on.
Well, it's a tricky thing, though, too, isn't it? Because like you, I mean, first of all, your everything about your livelihood, the performance itself, everything hinges to some degree on approval because it's performative. And yeah. approval is the thing that you should, that should not be your main, that that's probably best if you don't give a fuck. And that does seem like it would be, that's a hard line, it's just completely at odds. I don't see many performers who navigate that as well.
And I think approval that's seeking can be a great initial impetus yes. and fire to get you started and to get one focused on learning the craft, which takes years and years and years. But it really is the enemy of a creativity, ultimately.
Yeah. It is, and it's such a wormhole. You, like you say, you try to act like you don't care, and musicians constantly brand themselves that way. It's like, yeah, I don't give a fuck. I don't care. I'm just here. It's like, well, they're not. That's not really honest. Yeah. But it's. I guess it's a good. I guess that's. It's a. Maybe that's just a phase that we have to go through.
Yeah. Apparently.
Yeah.
I think so.
You know. Well, with that exercise you were talking about being in your room, it's, you know, as a musician, that's totally where I started. Like, I didn't think about being on a stage. Everything that drove me about getting good at music stayed in my room until I was older. And I know that there are a lot of musicians who did it because they could get chicks, and that's great later on. But that really wasn't in my mind to begin with. And there is something cool about what do you do when nobody's looking, you know? So I think that exercise that you're talking about is actually really brilliant. Just watching someone in their room.
Yeah. 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 I agree.
Have you ever tried the 24-hour musicals or the 24-hour plays?
You know, I was among the very first people that ever did one of the 24-hour plays. It started in New York. I think I was in the second time they had ever done it in New York City. I think the space was called Nada. It was a downtown performance space. This was around 1992, 93, mm-hmm. something like that. So I did a 24-hour plays way, 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 way back ago.
Way before it was cool.
So before it was cool. Yeah.
I did the 24-hour musicals later on, I don't know, maybe about 8 years ago. And one of the things that struck me was that my group worked really hard and got things right. Like, and there was another group where two of the actors were just hell-bent to improvise. And everyone loved it. They were so popular. Like, and I kept thinking, but they're just fucking around. Like they didn't do, I know they didn't do the script that was written. They just made up stuff in the song. They were like making half of it up. And from my point of view, because we prepared all night and we got it right and it wasn't as well received. And it made me think about like, gosh, you know, like you put this stuff together and then the thing in the moment, like I could stop any of my shows and play a cover of anything. And everyone be like, yeah.
Yeah.
At any point in your career, it's like you're going to play a blues song or something. It's like, well, they do that down at the Four Seasons Lounge. And like people like it. Yeah. Like, haven't I gotten beyond that? But there's something that people love in the moment. And I think that comes back to to approval is like.
Here's a good one for you.
Okay.
Don't Stop Believing by Journey.
Oh, yeah. Or.
Just bust that out.
The Bon Jovi song, this one. Oh, we're halfway there. Oh,
living on a prayer. Does he sing that? That's Bon Jovi singing like Steve Perry.
It is. That's why it kind of hit me that way. What's great about that is that second half, it hits the hook and you think that's all the dopamine you've got to release. And then it goes, whoa, we're halfway there. That happens with most people's beginnings of the chorus. And then the second line goes, whoa. And that's where the audience actually sings. I think that's pretty brilliant.
That's pretty good. That's pretty damn good songwriting.
Yeah.
I met someone who had been in a Bon Jovi cover band. I think they were called John Bovey. And awesome. I was like, Do you just play Living on a Prayer like over and over again? I don't know any other Bon Jovi songs.
Oh, there was
like
that Steel Horse song.
Steel Horse I Ride.
That was Bon Jovi, right?
Okay, and I don't know. I don't know any other Bon Jovi songs. He said that he had like 10, 20 top 10 hits. Who knew? Who knows? Good looking dude. Give him that.
We're exactly like pretty much exactly the same age. Do you know anything at all about the 80s? I just was hiding or something. I don't know shit about the 80s. Don't know anything about it.
I know a lot about kind of indie music from the 80s because right. I was listening to a lot of like Replacements.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, stuff XTC I liked from England mm-hmm. and.
Yeah,
I liked old ska and the Clash, and so I was doing a lot of kind of musical discovery in the 80s. But yeah, other than that, I don't know. Was Reagan years?
Reagan was the president. Yeah, because when I was, I don't know, maybe sometime in the early 2000s, somehow I got booked on some show. On VH1, like three times in a row about the 80s. And it's just a bunch of talking heads, and they'll say, and how about those? And I don't know why they kept having me on, because I didn't know any reference points. I remember Cabbage Patch Dolls, and I didn't know what Cabbage Patch Dolls were. And then there were all these movies I'd never heard of.
Right.
And it's kind of, I don't know, I see you strike me as maybe you might not have been.
No, I'm the same way. I mean, people, I can imagine they're asking you about Paula Abdul and Die Hard. And it's like, I don't know. I don't know from that. I remember reading an article that was like, remember the crash, the Wall Street crash of Black Monday in 1987? And this and that happened. It's like, I was going to acting school in New York City. So I was right there, you know, a few miles from Wall Street. And I have zero recollection that that happened. Because my life was just about, oh, I'm going to read this Brecht play, and I'm going to get a cheap, shitty coffee and eat a bagel and go into my acting room and sweat and jump around. So
Do you read or listen to news or consume news, or you try to stay away from that?
I look at the – I deleted the Apple News app because I became addicted to it.
Yeah, I know. Yeah,
it's,
I got you.
You know, because it's an algorithm-based news app. And it, like, if you read something about, I don't know, Magnus Carlsen playing chess, then it'll feed you all the Magnus Carlsen chess articles. Mm-hmm. Or if you read about the extinction of the monarch butterfly, then it'll send you. So it just knows what you like, just like Instagram does and all of these in YouTube.
Yeah.
And I'm just a sucker for these.
Me too.
Their algorithms. God damn them to hell. These information technology companies, they go right into my brain and they just, and I just keep pushing my screen.
You keep doing it. You can't help it. Well, is that anti-creative?
Yeah, because it's a time suck.
Yeah.
It's a time suck. How many hours per day are we looking at our phone when we could be learning Italian? Or we could be writing songs or screenplays or creating, you know, ceramic sculptures of penises?
Well, I've done a couple of those already today, but I managed to read the news as well. It's like, you know, a penis... Okay. Headline, another penis,
that's
another
smart.
Headline.
That's smart.
Yeah, I kind of keep one.
Hats off to you. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Because I do think that it is hard to create when you're consuming mindlessly. It's another thing if you're going from great book recommendation to the next one, but the kind of stuff you get online, and I get it too. I mean, I wake up in the middle of the night because I can't sleep, and I'll just pull up YouTube and they know what I like, and it's drum solos from the 70s. I've seen them all one after another. It's the most mindless thing in the world. Oh, there's a Johnny Carson. Yeah, I'm going to watch that again. He's really good. He's a good drummer.
Yeah,
I don't think it's good for me. I should be getting up and writing a song or something.
For me now, it's for some reason, it's like early. I watched that King Richard about Venus and Serena Williams, which I just loved, and I'm a big tennis fan and player of tennis, and now it's like tennis matches from the 90s and early 2000s, like all these battles between Martina Hingis and Serena Williams. It's fascinating tennis, great tennis. And I could just zone out for hours watching that shit. And YouTube knows it.
Yeah.
It knows me.
Well, there's the dude that he's Swiss and he's amazing and he does the tweeners. They called them tweeners.
Yeah.
Between the legs shots. What was it? He's always playing.
Federer.
Yeah. Yeah. I got hooked on those for a while on best of Federer
tweeners. Compilations.
Yeah. Tweener compilations. Yeah.
Yeah. I would hear this might be TMI for your audience. Forgive me. But then I would. While pooping, I would look at YouTube has this new kind of YouTube shorts, which is basically YouTube ripping off TikTok. And they're these short ones.
Right.
And then I would look at a couple while pooping and then finish and be on about my way. And then they would just get longer and longer. And then all of a sudden I'd realize, like, I've been sitting on this toilet 10 minutes post poop looking at these videos, you know?
That's when your legs go to sleep.
That's kind of gross. It gets kind of gross. You know what I mean? It crosses a line of like, that's unhygienic, actually.
Probably is.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's once it's dried, it's time to move on. I'm going to take a question because we get those. Can we get a question for, I don't know.
This question is for Rain. When you are writing or creating a scene, do you enjoy carefully planning out every part of the scene or leaving space for improvising?
Thanks. Who is that? Who is that weird disembodied voice? Well, you know, it really depends. So listen, thanks for the question, Satan. It really depends on if you're making comedy or not. If it's The Office, you know, we would do it as scripted, but then we would also riff and improvise. So that's my favorite way of working, is if you can allow for improvisation. And, you know, like Succession is my new favorite show and it's my new favorite obsession on HBO. And the script is incredible and the lines they come up with are amazing and so sharp and funny. I love to watch episodes even twice just to take in the dialogue. But then I read in an article about it that they also allow the actors to improvise. So it's like, wow, that's the best of both worlds when you have an incredible script with incredible dialogue and you get to improvise. Because you've got this miraculous thing called an editing room and you get to cut out the stuff that doesn't work. So God bless us, everyone.
Yeah, man, that's intense. When the few acting things I've done, I've had to jump in on really big budget stuff. And my first thought is, holy shit, I got to remember these lines. That's about as far as I can get. But then I realized they cover everything 1,000 times. Yep. So then you start to realize, oh, look, they've got like 10,000 feet of this garbage. So I can do it a little different. At some point, you know, that takes a while to understand. It's very scary.
Yeah. Yeah, indeed. Indeed. It does. It takes a while to get. That was once I got good at doing theater. It's a whole other thing at getting good in front of a camera, because when you're in theater, when you first do theater, you're self-conscious because there's an audience out there. Right. And you're like, what do I do with my hands? And which way do I turn? Can I turn upstage? And are they hearing me in the back row? And you have all of these. But once you get used to that and then you're comfortable there, then all of a sudden you're doing camera. But then you've got like this, you know, you've got this camera pointed at you.
Right.
And it's like, sometimes it's like 2 feet from your face and like, oh, pretend that camera's not there. Pretend this giant machine is not pointing at you and act as relaxed and naturally as humanly possible. So there's a whole nother series of kind of, because that relaxation allows for spontaneity and breath allows for, so breath, relaxation allows for spontaneity, allows for that illusion of the first time we were talking about.
Yeah.
But how do you do that? You know, I've seen so many of your videos where you're in front of orchestras, you know, and you're just kind of like, hey, clarinets, play. And then you're like, but you just are, it's as if you're in your living room, Ben. I mean, it's like, you're just like picking your nose and you're like, and you got, there's 800 people in front of you and it's being recorded. And you're like, what if they have the oboes go? Nah, let's not do that. How are you able to summon that kind of, that level of
That's relaxation? Not hard to me. I don't find that hard. It's an interesting thing about my brain that way. I'm an intense choker. I can blank and choke like nobody. And in this little gig that I'm doing here, that's mostly what I'm doing. Like, I can have a normal conversation, but this is very, very foreign to me. And I'm not going to try to pretend that I'm good at it. Oddly enough, when it would seem like it's more pressure, because there are 75 trained musicians who probably don't all like me very much on stage, and an audience that's looking at you and you're wasting everyone's time and money, I got no problem with that. I don't choke. I really don't know why. I mean, I did 5 seasons of this NBC show called Sing Off, and it was sort of a music judging show, and it was like, you know, at 8 o'clock and everything. It was like, it's a prime time thing. And I had to take on choking as being part of my persona. I had to be like, okay, well, I'm the professor of music here, so I can talk much more slow. but I was choking the whole time, and that's why, right. I couldn't be an actor. Like, it blows me away to see. I think I'm very attuned to when I see good acting. Well, everyone thinks that, but mainly because I'm empathizing with the performer almost every time, and I'm going, I choked. I'm choking. How are you doing this? I don't know how you do it. Blows me away. I got no problem with the orchestra. That's fine. Bring the orchestra in here, and I'll make 5 songs for you with them. I've got no problem with that. Isn't that weird?
Well, we're in the right business then, aren't we, Ben?
It's all working out. But one day, yeah, when I grow up, I enjoy the wormhole of the acting stuff. But because I think it's much more intense. It's not what people think when you do it.
Yeah.
Yep. And I think that all the things that I think are important, I don't see them occur that often, and they occur randomly for me when I see the little bits of TV that I do, and I'll just see a person, I'll go, well, like the show you were talking about, Succession. I saw a couple of those. There's a lot of that going on in that show. Like, there's a lot of the thing that I like to see, and I don't know what it's called. It's Discovery. Maybe that's what it is.
Yeah, surprise, astonishment. It's funny, there was a lecture I was listening to about and I forget who it was, talking about storytelling, and they broke down these basic elements of storytelling. Here's what people like in stories, and they just visited 1,000 stories and tested out stories on people and what have you. And it's like, here's what people like. And they like a narratology, character. They like a narrative. They like some action. Mm-hmm. They like a, you know, plot twist. You know, they like a resolution, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But one of the things they discovered is that they like to be surprised.
Right.
And not even like a plot twist surprise, like, oh, I didn't see that coming. But just like someone doing something that they just, they just did not expect. But a basic element of storytelling is being
surprise,
really caught off guard. And I love that when I'm watching a story and I see something just out of left field, a choice or a character doing something I've never seen them do before on a TV show. I just love it. I'm a giddy schoolgirl.
Well, that's the center, in my opinion, of a good song. You know, there's a lot of things to a good song, but one of them would be, okay, well, we know we're going to hit the chorus. That's not a surprise.
Yeah.
How can you hit the chorus in a way that resembles life and that it didn't happen the way you thought exactly would? But of course, you turn 20. We all turn 20. It looks like my nuts dropped and everything happened like it's supposed to. But something about it. And then there's the second chorus. Well, you just heard the first chorus. How can you be make it a different world for the second chorus? And to me, that's always been, if you can do that in a song, then you have a good song. And I think that works for almost any song.
And what about the bridge? What do no one talks about the bridge? What about the humble bridge? Why do so many bridges suck? It's just kind of like you have a great verse and then like da 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 rocking chorus back to the verse. Da 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 da. Okay, this is in my earworm. I'm totally in this. And then all of a sudden you've got, and then the time you don't ignore the times you've been outside before. And then you're back to verse and chorus.
Yeah.
But it's really like, it's just filler.
That's interesting. Well, I think a bad bridge. Well, there's what people call, or I've heard it called, a Tom Petty bridge, where you just change to another chord for a second, then get back to it. And that's actually a very honorable sort of bridge. Now, I can't give you an example, but that's like when you're writing or recording, there's often the kind of person who goes, you know, oh, that's good. That's a Tom Petty bridge. And I don't know. Maybe a lot of people call it that because it's not trying to introduce a new idea. So a bad bridge would be a bridge to me that tries to introduce an idea that's just, it doesn't need to be introduced, but there are great bridges too. And I wish I could speak in examples, but a great bridge should help get you to the third chorus in a way that allows you to see the world a little bit differently. And also, it's a natural, if you're freestyling a song.
Does a bridge need to be kind of, if the song's in major chords, does the bridge want to be in some minor chords to kind of help set up going back to the major chords? Does that help? Or,
well,
I don't know.
There's this really great Paul Simon interview with Dick Cavett, and he's in the middle of writing.
Did you happen to see that on YouTube at 3 a.m.?
I did. Yeah.
Guilty.
Next to the drum solos. Have you seen it?
No.
Well, I saw that, and then I saw Old Man Surprises Karate Expert and Kicks His Ass in an Alley, and then I saw more drum solos. That's actually what I saw. Paul Simon is in the middle of writing Still Crazy After All These Years, and he doesn't know yet. He knows he wants to go to the bridge and do something, but actually, as of the time of the interview, he didn't know what he wanted to do. And he does kind of what you're saying. He's looking for notes that he hasn't used at all in the song. So he says, I think I'm going to base it around these two notes. I haven't used those notes at all in the melody, and I would like to go to those two notes. And that's the way, I guess, he must have thought of it. But it's a great bridge. It's a 4 in the morning, da-da-da-da-da.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
That's a good bridge. You like that bridge, yeah?
I love that bridge.
Yeah,
what's your favorite bridge you've ever made, written?
That I've ever written?
Yeah.
Shit, I don't know. I don't really have favorite. I block my mind on favorites when it comes to my stuff because I don't want to offend the efforts of the other ones. I think of them as, it's like they all have been eaten out of the same bowl. It's like a litter, and I don't want to upset the runt or something.
Is a bridge sometimes a cast-off melody that you might have used for another song, but you couldn't ever figure it out?
I think those are probably bad. I think those are probably bad bridges. I think it needs to grow out of, when I'm freestyling a song, I find that form begins to make sense. Like when you're learning to write a song, you go, oh, okay, well, I go, you know, intro, verse, chorus, bridge, half chorus out or something like that. You have this form in your mind. When you're freestyling, you're not thinking of form, but you start to realize, oh, I'm kind of getting bored of this. And then you do something else. You're like, oh man, I better sum this up. I'm going to lose everyone. Like I'm not going anywhere. And then you have one word that sums it up, and it doesn't have to be clever. It just, ooh, that's your chorus. And then you're like, okay, I'm going to go back and explain a little bit more. And you go back to the verse. So the bridge is the point where it's like, I'm wearing motherfuckers out now. It's time to do something a little bit different. And so you find yourself, or you think, maybe everything I'm saying is not right. Maybe I doubt this a little bit, or there's an exception. And I think the bridge is really, really good for those things. I just think that there are a lot of shitty bridges, and that's probably what you're remembering. But I could probably, if it was an assignment, you know, like send you 10 great bridges that would make you think you liked bridges.
I think this should be an assignment for you for this pod or something. And that would be a great YouTube video that would show up on my algorithm. Ben Folds talks his way through the 10 greatest bridges of all time. Folks, are you listening?
Yes.
Can we pin Ben down on this?
Let's
do it. The 10 greatest bridges of all time. Is laughing on the bus playing games with the faces, the man in the gabardine suit as a spy, is that a bridge?
Or the fuck is that? What is that?
He said, be careful, the bow tie was really a camera. You're talking about Paul Simon songs.
Oh, what's Paul Simon song is that? I don't know that, I don't think.
Simon and Garfunkel. Laughing on the bus.
God, I don't
playing
know that one.
Games with the faces. She said the man in the gabardine suit was a spy.
That's good.
No, you don't. You know that one?
Ah, it's really good, though.
I said, be careful, his bow tie is really a camera. It's all come to look for America.
Oh, yeah, I've heard that. I don't know it really well. Yeah. God, yeah. It's a beautiful chorus, though. Yeah, I've heard
and
that.
And I sing like a fucking angel.
Yeah, you do. You've got a good voice.
Yeah,
it's
serviceable.
And you're a bassoonist.
And I'm a bassoonist. I got my bassoon right over there.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm not any good on it. But
no, I think you're actually pretty good. I mean, we jammed last time.
A little bit. Yeah.
Yeah. I think you're good. I mean, did you play an orchestra when you were growing up?
I played. Yeah. There's another world. You know the movie Sliding Doors with Gwyneth Paltrow?
I know what it is. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's another world in which I went to the University of Indiana and became a professional bassoonist. And right now I'm like in the Houston Symphony Orchestra.
Yeah.
Bassoonist.
Yeah, or you're teaching.
Probably a lot fatter and a lot more depressed. But
do you know what?
A vital part of an orchestra. Yeah.
Sadly, there's very, very low job satisfaction in symphony orchestras.
I'll bet.
Yeah.
I'll bet.
I think that's too bad. I hate that. This is a life spent doing something that seemed like it should be creative, and they feel like it's not when they get into it often because of the, it's almost like being, it's like military.
Yeah, it's got to be rough, and they should be paid better too. I mean, I totally agree.
Yeah.
They're getting peanut pay, you know, they're making 60 grand a year. And they're some of the world's greatest musicians.
Well, what's astounding about
like
them being
the European, Vienna Symphony Orchestra, it might be the same thing, but you're like, fuck, I'm making 200-300 grand here and state subsidized and everyone knows my name and you feel like I'm part of something.
Yeah. Oh, over here we harbor the idea that it all has to be privatized. And as a result, even symbolically, we're not paying them enough. Yeah, I think that's a good point. If it's state supported, it's like the state, the people have said, this is really important. What you do is important. And over here, it's like, someone will pay for it. They want to play music. Someone will pay for it. And there's so many great musicians.
Capitalized. Yeah.
Imagine that, like every city, because I've played with most of the orchestras in the country. Even little towns have a symphony orchestra full of world-class musicians. That's how many there. That's amazing to me.
Yeah. I mean, the state subsidizes big agriculture. We subsidize. Right. People don't understand how much our government subsidizes oil exploration. In 2021, with climate change, we subsidize that. We subsidize big pharma.
Yeah.
We subsidize big mono agriculture because they get like family farm discounts. Tax. And it's like, but God forbid, a state or the feds give a couple $100,000 to a theater company or to a symphony orchestra. It's just culturally backwards.
It's culturally backwards and it's economically backwards too, because these are huge drivers. I mean, the arts are such a solid, proven investment. That our willfully ignoring that is one of the, it blows me away. I actually don't understand it. We all spend time talking about
it. It is bad capitalism from top to bottom because it revitalizes, downtown.
That's right.
And there's restaurants and coffee shops and parking, and then property values go up, and it's win-win-win all around to subsidize the arts.
Do you sound like you have experience touring, but I didn't notice that in anything things I've seen or read about you. Have you toured?
I toured with John Bovey. It's a cover band of...
that's right. That you know, you know one of their songs.
I play tambourine, so I didn't really need to know.
You don't have to know really where you are.
I played the tambourine of Living on a Prayer on every song that they played, so I don't know what those other songs were. But
if you want to see some great tambourining, watch the live video of the band Kansas playing Carry On My Wayward Son.
Carry on my wayward son.
peace with you.
Learn you want.
Watch him. Watch that guy. Watch and learn.
Is it like tambourine solo?
Totally. He went to like school for him. TIT, Tambourine Institute of Technology. He went there.
Ben, I got to go. I got to go pick up my son from school.
I know. Listen, I've been trying to figure out how to like land this plane, because I feel like I'm talking to the master of it.
I just landed it for you.
You landed it for me. Will you give us some advice before you go?
Sure.
What should we do this week as an exercise? If you were going to give us an artistic exercise, pull it out of your ass, something we do once a day for this week. Creative.
Find a plant or a tree.
Okay.
And I'm not kidding.
Yeah, no.
And as part of your morning practice, observe it. Check in with it. Notice how it changes in the light, how it might be growing, how it might be thriving, how's it doing in winter. And every day, check in on this plant or this tree and watch it very, very carefully. Get to know it, build a relationship with it. And I think that funny, still little miracles will happen inside.
That one stands out. I've gotten a lot of these, and that's a standout. Thank you. Hi, if you're enjoying listening to Lightning Bugs, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. It helps a lot.